For decades, historians portrayed Reconstruction as an era of corruption and bad government brought on by radical Republicans who wanted to punish the South after the Civil War. But our next guest, historian Douglas Edgerton, says the opposite was often true, that Reconstruction was the first progressive era in the history of the country, brought to an end by embittered racists who used intimidation and murder to silence black activists, revoke their right to vote, and ushered in the Jim Crow era. Edgerton notes that during Reconstruction, thousands of black veterans, activists, ministers, assemblymen registered to vote, and 1,500 were elected to office. Their children attended public schools. But what happened? Douglas Edgerton with the brief, violent history of Reconstruction after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. 150 years ago this fall, when a Northern victory in the Civil War was all but certain, more than 140 African Americans from 18 states convened in Syracuse, New York, to discuss the future of blacks in a post-war America. Led by the abolitionist Frederick Douglass, they demanded the end of slavery and a new age of political equality. In fact, they got a great deal of what they wanted in the brief era known as Reconstruction. But our next guest says most of the gains were short-lived, as embittered Southerners mounted a counter-revolution of legal disenfranchisement and lethal violence that ushered in the Jim Crow era. Douglas Edgerton, a historian at Lemoyne College in Syracuse, argues that the Reconstruction era has suffered a bad rap, even from mainstream historians, as a period of corrupt and ineffective government dominated by outsiders and incapable black freemen, all foisted on the South by a punitive Congress. But Douglas Edgerton's new book, The Wars of Reconstruction, argues that the opposite was often true. Despite foot-dragging from an avowed racist president and a recalcitrant Congress, a group of black veterans, activists, ministers, assemblymen, registrars, poll workers, editors, and a handful of dedicated white allies actually made the decade after the Civil War the most democratic in the 19th century and what Douglas Edgerton calls America's most progressive era. Millions of blacks were enfranchised. Their children attended public schools for the first time. Many of the schools integrated. And 1,500 African Americans, listen to that number, 1,500 African Americans were elected to office, including the first black congressman and senator. But Southerners, he writes, were determined to restore the old order of things, if not slavery itself. As federal troops were withdrawn from the South, they began a guerrilla war of intimidation and outright homicide against African American leaders, and a legislative war that effectively eliminated blacks' right to vote. It did not return until a new generation of black leaders spearheaded the civil rights movement almost a century later. Douglas Edgerton says he's been fascinated by the Civil War period since childhood conversations with his grandmother, the daughter of a former planter and slaveholder. Although he grew up in Arizona, Douglas Edgerton, as a scholar, has concentrated on the intersection of race and politics in the South in early America. He earned his doctorate at Georgetown, and joining the history faculty at Lemoyne College, a Jesuit liberal arts school in Syracuse, New York, he's the author of six books, including Year of Meteors, Stephen Douglas, Abraham Lincoln, and the Election That Brought on the Civil War. His most recent is a fascinating and readable history called The Wars of Reconstruction, The Brief Violent History of America's Most Progressive Era. It's available from the Bloomsbury Press. Douglas Edgerton, I welcome you to Midday WYPR in Baltimore. I've been eager to speak with you about this. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Good to talk to you.
And so we're all on the same page about Reconstruction. We'll just go back to history class here for a moment. Reconstruction, was it a time period? Does that refer to a series of laws, a series of events, or maybe all of those?
Well, all of the above. It's a process in many ways. Historians love to apply periodization to things, and so mm-hmm. kind of the classic periodization is the end of the Civil War, then you have Reconstruction until 1877. I think it's much more complicated than that. As you mentioned a few moments ago, I think in many ways it began here in Syracuse in October of 1864 when all these delegates met at the Wesleyan Methodist Church. It still exists, by the way. It's a Mexican restaurant. It's
really
not very. It's not very good. Then the last black congressman to retire from Congress, George Henry White, doesn't leave until 1901. So I see Reconstruction as kind of a very long period that ebbs and flows. And one of the things I tried to do in this book was get the story as much as possible out of Washington, D.C., although you can't ignore the kind of harm that Andrew Johnson does to the process, but get it out into the trenches, north and south, because black Americans regarded this as a national crusade and not simply something that the former Confederacy needed. And look at people who are activists, poll workers, teachers, evangelicals, North, South, Philadelphia, Alabama, who really want to finally make America practice what it preaches, which, of course, is the promise that Lincoln makes in the Gettysburg Address. And so, you know, if you simply look at what's happening in Congress, you can see the spats between the so-called moderate Lincoln and the more progressive so-called radical Republicans like Thad Stevens and then the more very conservative white Democrats in Washington. But if you look at the people like Douglas and Jermaine Logan who are meeting here in Syracuse, I mean, they're making demands about voting rights, equal pay for soldiers. A lot of them have sons in the military. The Congress doesn't get behind for another 2 or 3 years. And so there's this big kind of push coming from the outside. And it was that push I wanted to write about in the book that I thought had been kind of neglected.
Well, I think that's where the book is most effective. And during this hour, I hope that you'll take us to places like Georgia and Mississippi and Louisiana and talk about some of those folks, Charleston, and I'll throw some of those names at you, Tunis Campbell, Blanche Kelso Bruce, Robert Smalls. All those names are going to be mentioned during our show today, and you'll get to talk about them. And we're going to bring it home to Baltimore in a little while as we talk about a judge in Baltimore, Hugh Lennox Bond, and how he figured in Reconstruction. There's a forgotten judge whose memory will revive today during our discussion with Douglas Edgerton. Now, you talk about how, you know, Americans of a certain age learned some very misleading things about Reconstruction. You say a lot of these things were myths. And I, you know, that older outlook of Reconstruction is certainly the one inscribed in the clay tablets I studied in history class, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. So I think we ought to go over that for folks, how we came to believe what we believed about Reconstruction and what modern historians say about it today.
Sure. I mean, what happens for much of the 20th century and the late 19th century is for white conservatives who are pushing back against the kind of progress made in Reconstruction, they have to find a way to kind of rationalize what's happening. And so, of course, their argument is, well, you know, black Americans are not yet ready for the responsibility of political power. It's also kind of a way for the North and South to come together. And you actually kind of see this culturally in films like Gone with the Wind, in which there's some kind of shared blame. And so white America can kind of unify around this question. So the kind of classic historical image you would get if you went to, and this is Northern schools as well, but also schools like Johns Hopkins, well until the 1950s, early 1960s, is that the White South was wrong to secede and start the war, but the North was equally wrong to impose this kind of vindictive policy on the South. And so if you kind of cut away the activists and the, especially the former slaves, and just kind of look at it from that point of view, then people can kind of rally around that, which is why, you know, films like Gone with the Wind remain so popular, and not just, you know, in Georgia, but up here in New York. You know, the last chapter in the book deals with memory and the way that the White South kind of wins the intellectual war about Reconstruction by depicting it as being punishment, as being vindictive.
Mm-hmm.
And the book ends, though, with John Hope Franklin, the late great historian, John Hope Franklin, who in 1963, for the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation, published the first kind of really big modern rebuttal to this view, at least since Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, whose book back in the 1930s was pretty much ignored. And Franklin's book sort of really led historians to think anew about Reconstruction. And then certainly the violence of the 1950s and the 1960s, which many historians call the second Reconstruction, the images that we all saw when I was growing up in Arizona, the police dogs, the fire hoses on television, the courage of young activists, started historians kind of think anew about this question. But it still really resonates in the popular consciousness. I give a lot of public talks, and there's, not just in the South, a lot of pushback to the idea that there was anything progressive about this. And people are kind of determined to see it as some sort of vindictive punishment. So I'm still dealing with students who've been, you know, raised and been educated in high school to think that there was something kind of flawed about the entire process of Reconstruction.
Well, what were some of the good things that Reconstruction states, state governments did? Let's go over some of that.
Sure. I mean, the two best things, I mean, obviously democracy is one.
I mean, look at South.
Yeah, I mean, you look at South Carolina, for example. When you know, the older generation of historians talks about Reconstruction being a punishment to the South, well, let's remember that the term Southerner is a biracial term. And so when the war breaks out, when South Carolina secedes in December 1860, the state is 61% black. So the typical South Carolinian is a black person in chains. 1870, just 10 years after secession, South Carolina elects its first black congressman, Joseph Rainey. In the 1870s, three of its four congressmen are people of color. So finally, the state has a congressional delegation that looks like the state, that represents the state. Thanks to the Military Reconstruction Act of 1867, the Confederacy, not Maryland, get back to that in a second, gets voting rights for African Americans. And suddenly, for the first time in 1867, every adult male in South Carolina has the right to vote. And so, you know, democracy, for those of us who think it's a good thing, you know, admire that advance. And then the one that people like Hugh Bond, we'll talk more about in a few minutes, were involved with was education. Education makes just enormous strides in the South during Reconstruction, all the way down to the dawn of the 20th century. One of the bits of data I talk about in the book, in 1860, about 90% of African Americans nationwide were illiterate, non-literate. Thanks to Freedmen's Bureau schools. By 1870, that had dropped to 70%. By 1900, it was down to 50%. That's still not good, although a lot of that's simply due to Southern poverty and the geographical distance between schools. And so white illiteracy in the South, well into the 20th century, is also, you know, pretty bad by comparison, say, to New England or here in New York. In the 35 years after the war, there's a 400% increase in literacy in what had been the Confederacy. And that's just a marvel.
You mentioned the Freedmen Bureau. You said the Freedmen Bureau schools. Could you talk a little bit about the Freedmen Bureau?
Yeah, the Freedmen Bureau was created on Lincoln's suggestion in the early spring of 1865, shortly before his assassination. It was kind of a combination Red Cross, Labor Bureau, it did all kinds of things. It actually was a branch of the military. It had no separate budget, so it was actually run under the auspices of what was then called the War Department. But it was designed to deal with abandoned lands. It has a very long formal title, and abandoned lands is part of the title. So it's to deal with displaced people, to hand out food, and early on, about a quarter of the food they hand out goes to impoverished whites who have been broken by the war. So it's not simply for former slaves, although primarily. Since so many ex-slaves were illiterate, often by state law, they couldn't read labor contracts, and so bureau officials would read contracts between former masters and freed slaves. And part of their mandate was to set up schools. And within 4 years of the end of the war in 1869, there were 3,000 bureau schools all across the South with 150,000 children. Wow. In those schools.
Right.
And again, that's American taxpayer dollars at work. It's, you know, War Department funding. But you know, that's an amazing undertaking.
Douglas Edgerton is our guest in this hour of midday. We're talking about his book, The Wars of Reconstruction. Douglas Edgerton, a historian. The subtitle of the book, The Brief Violent History of America's Most Progressive Era. We're back in Reconstruction after post-Civil War. When we come back, we'll go tell you about that forgotten Baltimore judge whose progressive activism on and off the bench helped blacks after the Civil War during this period we're talking about. More with Douglas Edgerton when we get back. And this is Midday on WYPR. Dan Roderick's here, having a conversation this hour with Douglas Edgerton, historian at Le Moyne College in New York. He spent his career studying race and politics in early America and how those issues resonate today. He's here to discuss his book, his new book, The Wars of Reconstruction, The Brief Violent History of America's Most Progressive Era, an eminently readable narrative of that turbulent and misunderstood period. It will certainly open the eyes of many people, North and South, who always learned Reconstruction as an era of corruption and bad government foisted on the South by a vengeful Congress. Professor Edgerton, back with Douglas Edgerton now. And I'd like to bring this to Baltimore because you open a chapter of your book with the story of Hugh Lennox Bond, Professor Edgerton, this interesting man who admitted to the Maryland Bar in 1851. He practiced law here during the Civil War until 1860. Anyway, he was appointed a judge of Baltimore's criminal court. And I wish you would tell our listeners a bit about this forgotten judge who's buried here in the Greenmount Cemetery in Baltimore. But tell us about him, and then maybe it'll become obvious why you chose to hold him up as an example of a progressive in this era.
Sure. I came across him actually while I was reading newspapers. And he is one of these kind of forgotten activists, maybe we could say even a forgotten hero. So forgotten, in fact, that I could not find a picture anywhere of him. His papers are at the Maryland Historical Society. I did research there, but there's no image of him. He came from old money. He was well established, as was his family. Educated in law in New York. He was a very devout Methodist, a good evangelical. He was in his early 30s when the war broke out. So a little bit too old to fight. He'd been a Whig, and the Whigs, that was the party of Henry Clay, the party of Daniel Webster. It was the party of business, moral reform. They believed in the federal government having the power to be the wise steward of the economy and moral reform. And I liked him because he was an example of how the war changes people. Because I mean, he was a good man to start with, and he'd never been on the slavery bandwagon. But he didn't vote for Lincoln in 60. He thought Lincoln was too liberal in 1960. He voted for John Bell, who was a former Whig, and in fact a slaveholder. But then the war radicalized him, and he was really appalled at the clearly pro-Confederate interests of Maryland Democrats, and also I think he was also radicalized to an extent by what he saw in the Baltimore criminal court, because the people who were dragged before his court were disproportionately black, quite often very young, they actually had kind of sentencing guidelines in those days, and so he wasn't able to do as much for these sort of young offenders as he thought he should have. And so he becomes a very good and ardent Republican. Finally, President Grant in 69 puts him on the federal circuit court. He lives until a very ripe old age and spent his off hours working for moral reform, educational reform, and becoming a very, very progressive person. You know, if the death of nearly 700,000 young men doesn't change the way people think about their country, about society, then nothing will. So I wanted to use him, and this is the chapter on teachers, on evangelicals, on white carpetbaggers, who again have gotten this kind of terrible image, but who in fact really just kind of wanted to change the world, because he's symptomatic of that. Somebody who was always, you know, a good guy to start with, but really started thinking anew about his country because of the war.
I really like this fellow. The more I read about him in your book, Judge Bond, who took some heat, of course, for his views. In Maryland, there were pro-Confederate sympathies, obviously. He particularly protested this policy, this onerous policy of federal bonuses to white masters who enlisted their slaves in the military and then later wanted to be compensated for having done that.
He thought that. The United States, of course, by 1863 was recruiting African-American soldiers, and quite often that meant in loyal slave states like Maryland, where the Confederate impulse wasn't all that strong, but certainly the pro-slavery impulse was pretty robust. And so to get masters to sign their slaves up, the masters would get a bonus. And he thought that was wrong because, of course, if you are a white carpenter and your son enrolls in the military, he would get paid a salary, but you wouldn't get a bonus for that. And you know, again, as an evangelical, Bond thought that there was something morally wrong, essentially, in rewarding somebody for doing what he thought is the right thing to do in any case.
Right. And some of these slaveholders or former slaveholders wanted to be compensated after the war, right?
As strange as it sounds now, there were a lot of masters, especially in non-Confederate states, Kentucky, Maryland, Missouri, who really thought the war was going to end and they would still be able to hold on to their slaves or something very much like it. And one of the things that states like Maryland, a lot of southern states did, was to pass laws essentially turning kind of children into apprentices, black children. On the kind of strange grounds that because white masters had invested a certain amount of money in children who hadn't yet then become productive workers, that they were owed something. And so they would give these children freedom. We're talking about 11-year-old boys. But then they would be apprenticed to their former master until they were about 18. So the parents would take the masters to court. And Bond always found in favor of the parents and just infuriated his critics, and his hate mail is really quite amazing, and it's a testimony to him that he saved it all. There's an entire file of his hate mail at the Maryland Historical Association.
Really?
Instead of throwing it away or burning it, he kept it.
Oh, I would like to spend some time reading that. We're speaking of Hugh Lennox Bond. My guest in this hour of the show is Douglas Edgerton, historian whose book is about Reconstruction, the Wars of Reconstruction. And this Baltimorean, this Baltimore judge from a well-to-do family here, Hugh Lennox Bond, I also think it was interesting that he criticized fellow Methodists. He said, "No Methodist congregation in Maryland has yet contributed 1 cent toward the education of colored Methodists." And let me just read from your book here why you chose him. You say, Hugh Lennox Bond, was typical of the tens of thousands of white activists and progressive evangelicals who were radicalized by the war and its immediate aftermath, reviled in older scholarship and popular mythology as selfish, insincere carpetbaggers. These earnest militants labored beside black ministers and veterans to build churches and schools. That's why he's in your book.
Yeah, he would go give speeches and critics were turned up in the back with racist banners. But, you know, as far as he was concerned, he and God run the same side. And if that's the case, then you can have your critics. And he just had this kind of serene confidence that what he was doing was basically God's work. And he was very critical. This is where actually, you know, a number of abolitionists like Frederick Douglass, of Americans who professed to be good Christians, but then didn't act on that premise, and quite often it was New England benefactors who were helping to support schools for black children in Maryland and not local white Methodists. And right, as I point out in the book, Bond was very critical of that group.
Douglas Edgerton, I'm so eager to ask you about that number I cited in the introduction to today's hour with you, 1,500, the operative number here for the number of blacks elected to office during this period that we're discussing Reconstruction. First, you know, how do we know that number? Did you personally track all of these elected officials? But that's almost secondary to the main question is,
right?
How did this happen? I'm sure it's even a shock maybe to some people to hear that that many blacks were elected in those years after the Civil War.
As to your first question, now the wonderful historian Eric Foner, now retired from Columbia, actually some years ago put his grad students to work on that issue, and Southern papers would always identify people by party and by race. So if you are a black congressman, you give a speech, they would have in parens colored or Negro or worse. So identifying people by race, even if there was not a photograph, actually is pretty easy to do. So 1,510 identifiable people of color, and many of them are mixed race, so hence the term people of color, serve state, local, national office. And the ones who've gotten the most attention are the 21 men, like Robert Smalls, who get elected to the National Congress, or the two, Blanche Bruce, Hiram Revels, who were elected to the U.S. Senate. But again, the others are sheriffs. They are state assemblymen, mostly. They helped to write all the new state constitutions that is required of the South in the years after the war. And they're the ones kind of really down in the trenches. And I think if you really want to see where the action is, that's where to look.
How did they get elected? I think our listeners would be eager to know that. It seems almost shocking.
Well, they're in black districts. And mm-hmm. to pick on the North a little bit, the 1,510 identifiable African-American politicians, none of them are from the North. Or if they are from the North, they're elected from the South. Okay. They're veterans who just kind of wind up down there. Even white Republicans in the North were not going to vote for people of color. So these are people who are from places like Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina, which have, of course, heavily black districts. So as soon as blacks can vote in South Carolina after 1867, and you've got counties that are 92% black, you know, down near the coast. And so it's places like that that are electing people of color.
All
so
right.
upcountry white districts are not.
That helps very much because, you know, one could get the impression that the abolitionists, the Northerners who, you know, favored abolition would be magnanimous in their voting. But this was strictly done because of the dominance of blacks in districts and their new right to vote.
Sure, and they wanted people who would represent, as we all do in any election, our interests, who understand our concerns. Of the 1,510, at least 130 were ex-military. 243 were ministers, and there's an overlap because, of course, a lot of them were Union chaplains, people like Hiram Revels. So these were guys who ran for office wearing their uniform, and that was like it was for my father's generation in, you know, 1945, 1946. That was a major selling point. I'll give you one more bit of data. Of the 180,000 African Americans who fight in the U.S. Army, 141,000 are former slaves. So a lot of people are you know, black Virginians. When the war is over, they just come back home with their gun and their uniform, and that's a key selling point. But they run for election.
Let's talk now about the Southern pushback. One of the real villains in your piece, and I think that's exactly the attitude you take toward him, was the president who succeeded Lincoln, Andrew Johnson. You refer to him as a racist, accidental president who just by neglect or design brokered deals with the Southern states. He removed federal troops there. He basically didn't care about what happened, is the impression one gets here. But please talk about him.
Yeah, he's the historian Ned Gordon Reed once remarked that America went from its best president to its worst in one awful night at Ford's Theater. You know, historians do kind of play the sort of odd game, the five greatest presidents, the five worst presidents. For my money, Johnson is the worst president. And it's not because Lincoln was the only person who could reconstruct America. It was that Andrew Johnson was exactly the wrong person. He was a Southern Democrat. He had not been, of course, for the Confederacy. He was a good Union man, but he owned slaves, a small number, until midway through the war. He had all the kind of classic racist perceptions that people from Tennessee, whites from Tennessee, had at the time. And for him, he didn't even like to use the word Reconstruction. He'd like to use the word restoration, implying that once the war was over, all was forgiven and whites could come back, and there was kind of very modest demands made on them. And he made it very clear early on that As long as there was no really overt attempt to re-enslave black Americans, that whatever the White South wanted to do was pretty much up to them. He really didn't like black Americans. There's a scene I talk about in the book where, I mean, it's after the big Syracuse convention. They deputized delegates to go down and meet with Johnson after Lincoln's assassinated, and try to make it clear what it is that black Americans would like to see happen. And Frederick Douglass goes, and his son Lewis Douglass goes. And bear in mind, Lewis Douglass is a wounded veteran. He gets all shot up at Fort Wagner in South Carolina. And Johnson, and they're so polite to Johnson. I mean, you know, they understand how power works in Washington. Johnson is just awful. And after they leave, he turns to his secretary, male secretary, and says, you know, Douglass is like any other Negro. And of course, he doesn't use the word Negro. And he says, he'd just like to stab me in the back if possible. Now, this is, you know, there was nothing in the meeting that would make one think that was the case. I'm convinced that there was a very large number of Southern whites who understood that they fought, they'd lost, no less than James Longstreet, who, of course, is Robert Lee's right-hand man after the death of Stonewall Jackson, writes a series of editorials in New Orleans paper, and he says, we fought, we lost, they won, they get to make the rules. And if we're smart, we'll go along and we'll just get back to our lives and get back to our businesses. Johnson's stubbornness and all the sort of green lights he gives to the handful of kind of real hardcore reactionary Confederates empowers that group and I think really kind of silences a lot of Southern white moderates who would have been happy to go along with any kind of reasonable Reconstruction program. So the extent of damage that Johnson does is really hard to underestimate.
Yeah. I agree from my reading of your book here. And the important point, one can't overstate the importance of the president's role in this when it comes to federal troops. This idea of removing federal troops from the South, that's the only organized armed force that was down there to protect the blacks, protect the black population against retaliation by the whites who wanted to restore white supremacy there.
Absolutely, and the main source for the book was the Freedmen's Bureau reports, which are housed at the National Archives in Washington. I would especially focus on a month or two before elections, October, November, in election years, and the correspondence coming from bureau agents in the South, especially in the lower South, Mississippi, Alabama, to Washington, were simply things like, we can't have an election here unless we have soldiers,
yeah.
Because they just killed the poll worker, they just killed the person handing out the ballots, and unless we have a patrol down here, we can't have fair elections. And so the drawdown of soldiers, and that wasn't just Johnson. A part of that, of course, had to do with the Indian Wars in the Midwest. But it made it very, very difficult to hold fair elections in the South.
Douglas Edgerton, our guest in this hour. Midday, we'll take another break here. Douglas Edgerton is a professor of history at Le Moyne College in Syracuse, author of several fascinating books about race relations in early America and the Civil War period in particular. His latest is the one we're talking about in this hour of Midday. It's called The Wars of Reconstruction, The Brief Violent History of America's Most Progressive Era. We'll take a short break and come right back. And welcome back to our History Hour here at Midday, sharing it with Douglas Edgerton, learning from him about the Reconstruction of the United States after the Civil War. The Wars of Reconstruction is his book, The Brief Violent History of America's Most Progressive Era. And we haven't spoken about the violence very much up to this point, certainly part of the pushback that I asked you about before the previous break. So I think we ought to address this here. Of course, the pushback, this attack on the progress blacks had made immediately after the war by Southerners. One was legal, something done, things that were done through the legislatures, but there was this other illegal attack, violence, arson, outright murder.
Yeah. I mean, first, of course, in 67, in response to black voting rights in the South, the Klan is formed. The book talks about some of the Klan activities, and there's of course a number of major atrocities. There's one in Colfax, Louisiana in 1873, in which about 50 black political activists, literally in a courthouse, are all murdered. The problem for Southern whites with that kind of violence is it attracted national attention. It appeared in newspapers. It attracted the wrath of President Grant, and it's also pretty easy to crush. I mean, Congress passed a law called the Klan Act, brought in federal marshals, brought in some soldiers, declared martial law, Grant did, in a number of South Carolina counties, and pretty much kind of put an end to the Klan pretty fast. And so what the White South learned from that is the danger of organizing in an illegal fashion, the danger and actually literally wearing a hood and engaging in kind of mass atrocities because, again, it'll get attention. So what they began to do, and it was much more effective, is you simply go after black activists one at a time. If there's a black poll worker, you wait outside his house, and when he walks out the next morning, you shoot him. Or as he's riding into town, and of course the South is a very, very large geography, so even when there are soldiers there, they can't be every place. And you just kind of ride up behind and hit him on the head with a rock and you ride away. And as long as you're doing this in groups of, you know, one, two, or three, there's not kind of a big witness base to deal with. And it'll make a bureau report. And so a bureau agent will write about that, which is how, again, you know, I found a lot of this data. But and it might even make the local newspaper. Benjamin Randolph, who's a South Carolina assemblyman, is shot getting on a train. But especially the one guy who's kind of disappeared in the dead of night, that's not going to make even the local papers. And so it's a much kind of safer way to kill political movements. And they understand that, you know, today's poll worker is tomorrow's state assemblyman, and tomorrow's state assemblyman is the next year's congressman, and the next year's congressman is a senator. And so if you get the person now, then you get them before they can get the kind of visibility that will make it then difficult to erase them later on. I mean, I talk about, it's not just the South. I talk about Octavius Cato, who's murdered on Election Day in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. He's 31. He's kind of single-handedly integrates streetcars in Philadelphia, and he's gunned down on Election Day, and an all-white jury lets the murderer go.
And that was in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Getting back to the South, and the point I raise, because you raised it in your book, is that about federal troops, the presence of federal troops, especially around election time. Congress, you say, was cutting the military budget across the board, leading to a reduction in federal garrisons in the South. I just wanted to cite these numbers that I pulled out in notes. In 1867, following the passage of the Military Reconstruction Act, 2,000 U.S. soldiers oversaw elections in Louisiana. That was in 1867. 2 years later, that number had dwindled to 598. By 1876, 9 years into Reconstruction, the number of Union soldiers had been reduced by 75%, rendering enforcement of the law impossible. Okay, that's from Douglas Edgerton's book. Congress certainly knew what it was doing and what was at risk there if that happened. These were deals made to appease Southern politicians?
Well, a lot of it was a lot of things. And again, part of it simply was the Indian Wars in the West. I mean, Little Bighorn is 1876, so mm-hmm. Reconstruction is still going on. And the 10th Cavalry, which is a virtually all-black cavalry, they're out West. You know, they should have been in Alabama. Instead, they're out West dealing with Native Americans. Part of it is what you see at the end of every war. You know, young men want to go home. The war is over. They want to go back and marry their sweethearts and go back to their businesses and their farms. I think also a lot of it was that Congress didn't really have a sense of how hard this process was going to be and how some white Southerners really would dig their heels in. So part of that's just kind of hindsight. I mean, we know now that what was really needed was to keep large numbers of troops in the South for decades. And that was what black activists were calling for. As far as they were concerned, if it took 100 years to impose democracy on Alabama and cost a lot of taxpayer dollars, then, you know, they thought that was a worthwhile venture. You know, if you compare American Reconstruction to, say, Reconstruction of Germany or Japan post-World War II, you know, why was the process so difficult in the United States? I mean, you know, by comparison, dealing with Nazis or Japanese fascists. And I think, you know, part of it was that Truman was not Andrew Johnson. That, you know, Johnson made it very clear that they could kind of do whatever they wanted. But the other part of it was there is, you know, there still is a American military presence in Western Germany. And that simply was, I think, something that only black activists, people like Judge Bond, really understood at the time.
Douglas Edgerton, I said in the early part of the show I wanted to ask you about some of the folks you write about. You've made reference to them here out in the states, in the counties where they ran for office or held office of some kind. So let me just state these names, and then you tell us a little bit about these folks, because this is what I think is the most brilliant part of the book. Tunis Campbell. Tell us about Tunis Campbell. This is in Georgia.
Tunis Campbell is a northern-born activist. He actually had been working. These are all really interesting people. He'd been working in the restaurant business, and he published a book on how a restaurateur or a hotel manager can make his customers happy. It's, by the way, still in print. People are still reading this at hotel schools.
And he's a freedman, right?
Yes, right. He's born free in the North. Serves in the military. When the war is over, he's in Georgia and he stays there. He becomes a sheriff. It's in the area called the Sea Islands, you know, down near the Georgia Carolina coast. He's in charge of schools. The whites, of course, just despise him because he's also a big guy. He's kind of hard to intimidate. Again, he's ex-military. They finally trump charges up and put him in prison at hard labor. He actually has a ball and chain attached to his leg. But these are people, you know, again, who understand that there's kind of going to be a cost for their activism. And especially for former soldiers, they're pretty hard to intimidate. And they're willing to endure a certain amount of hardship. In his case, he really pays the price. His time in prison on just these absurd charges.
You say he supervised resettlement.
Right. Again, long story, there's a very long area along the Carolina coast that stretches into Georgia. That's captured very early on by American naval forces and American military forces. And so when Truman actually arrives in Savannah, for about a year and a half, there essentially have been kind of no whites in the area called the Carolina Low Country or the Sea Islands. And so he's in charge of working with the Bureau and resettling people onto abandoned lands and plantations. And so as Johnson comes along, or Johnson's people come along and say, well, you know, the whites are going to have the land back. Campbell tells his people to stand firm. This is their land, that it was set aside. The Lincoln wanted them to have this land. Lincoln actually does use the term 40 acres when he's talking about maybe what blacks should get
right
after the war, simply at least in terms of land that's just clearly abandoned, which there is no clear owner after the war. And so Campbell is working very hard to keep former slaves, you know, on a piece of land that will be theirs, and to keep white politicians off.
And for that reason, he got a ball and chain. Let me ask you another name, Blanche Kelso Bruce.
Blanche Bruce is really interesting. He's actually born a slave in Virginia. As a slave, his name was Branch.
This is a man we're talking about. Blanche Bruce.
Blanche Bruce is
a guy. Okay.
I had an aunt named Blanche, but this is the guy. I guess he thought it was better than Branch.
Okay.
His master is also his father, so he's mixed race. And when the war comes, his white half-brother decides to go fight for the Confederacy, and Bruce decides that the time has come to decamp and free himself. He's living in Western Virginia and heads to Ohio, winds up and talks his way into Oberlin College, which is the first college to really kind of actively admit black and female students. Winds up in Mississippi, and like a lot of these guys, is kind of a one-man operation. He is a state superintendent for education. He's got a newspaper down there and serves in the state assembly. And, of course, in those days, it was the assembly that chose U.S. senators. They were not chosen by popular election where they are in the 20th century. And so he's chosen by Mississippi. So he's the first person to serve a full 6-year term as a person of color. But again, this is also why Frankly, he should have stayed in Mississippi. He gets to Washington, and of course he's a Republican, but white Republicans give him no responsibilities. He's in charge of no important committees. So he's a very important symbol for black Americans, but they don't really let him do anything. And his own party just kind of wants him as a symbol and not right. not an actor.
Right. So, Douglas Edgerton, we're getting close to the end of our hour together. Folks might be wondering, well, yeah, there was some progress made there despite all this pushback in the South and despite the racist accidental president after the Civil War, Andrew Johnson, and despite the recalcitrant Congress that was cutting the military budget so you couldn't have a larger federal troop presence in the southern states. Yeah, we get all that. I understand that. And that yet there was still progress made. But what happened to it? Why did this take another 100 years? Why are we still working on these things today?
Well, first of all, I mean, it didn't end every place. Now, bear in mind again, that thanks to the Military Reconstruction Act, the former Confederacy is divided up into five military jurisdictions, and they have to enlist blacks to vote. But that's only the former Confederacy. New York, where I live now, had a property qualification going back to 1821, pardon me, that it imposed on black voters. It did not impose on white voters. Only in New England could blacks vote on an equal basis with white males. In Lincoln's Illinois, blacks couldn't vote at all. In Thad Stevens, Pennsylvania, not at all. And of course, in Maryland, where you are, barely did the state even embrace emancipation in 1864. You probably know there's a new state constitution that's created by the end of the war that has to go to a popular referendum, and it's the referendum that abolishes slavery. It passes by 50.3% in Maryland.
That's right.
So and then Maryland won't ratify the 14th Amendment or the 15th Amendment. So when those things are ratified, they give blacks voting rights in Maryland, New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and those don't go away. So if you are a black barber, which is kind of a classic middle class black occupation in the 19th century in Chicago, Reconstruction never ends, and it doesn't end for your sons or your grandsons either. It ends in the South because it's killed. Robert Smalls, who is a former slave and a black congressman from South Carolina, once estimated 53,000 activists were systematically eliminated and assassinated. Think about that number. All Americans know about Gettysburg, where the casualties, killed and wounded, is a mind-numbing, ghastly 51,000. And they should know about that. But these are 53,000 poll workers, activists who are systematically eliminated in the dead of night by white vigilantes. And so in places like Mississippi, Reconstruction doesn't fail. It's killed.
Yeah. Douglas Edgerton is a professor of history at Lemoyne College. He's the author of several books, and the latest one is the one we've been discussing in this hour of midday, The Wars of Reconstruction, recommended reading from our staff here, The Brief Violent History of America's Most Progressive Era. It's published by Bloomsbury Press. Well, I enjoyed our conversation, Douglas Edgerton. Thank you so much for your
Me
book
too.
And
Thanks
for
so
being
much.
With us. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our midday for today. I hope you enjoyed the program. Dan Roderick's here for our staff. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you all again soon.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman in High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Rodrick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.